Pie in the Sky Media. This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. You're listening to episode 75, The Lady Killer. The Columbia River Gorge is less than an hour away from Portland, Oregon. It's a canyon that stretches 80 miles. And in the middle is the Columbia River, which meanders through these imposing cliffs, spires, and ridges. Around the Columbia River Gorge is Beacon Rock State Park, nearly 4,500 acres of pristine wilderness, ripe for exploration, hiking, biking, and horseback riding. And of course, the Columbia River, which is expansive and up to 4,000 feet deep, which means anglers flock to the area for the sturgeon, salmon, and steelhead fishing. But there's a special place that allows you to take in the abundant beauty of the land from the top of Beacon Rock. It's an imposing figure in the landscape, which was actually born out of violent destruction. Beacon Rock, at one time, was a molten lava plug buried deep inside a volcano that blew and then cooled millions of years ago. A very turbulent history, to be sure, but today, Beacon Rock is a popular tourist attraction. In fact, rock climbers gravitate to its face for some of the very best traditional climbing in the Pacific Northwest, which means scaling the rock without the use of any artificial or mechanical devices to help. At 848 feet high, it's a steep climb. But on November 27th, 1981, Randall Roth had brought his new wife, Janice, to Beacon Rock for a romantic day in nature, a hike up to the top, just the thing the day after Thanksgiving. The couple, along with Janice's daughter, Jelena, had traveled to the area to spend the holiday with Randy's parents, who lived just 20 minutes away from Beacon Rock. It was a chilly, overcast November day, but no rain, as the couple began the climb at the base of the rock. The last 9 months of their relationship had been a whirlwind. You see, Randy had met Janice in early 1981 at a Parents Without Partners event. Janice had an 8-year-old daughter, Jelena, and Randy had a young son named Greg. Janice was petite at 5'1 and 102 pounds. You could say that Randy swept her off her feet because she was an avid dancer. It was one of her favorite pastimes. And he was a charming and attentive man. And they got close very quickly. In fact, it wasn't long before Randy had proposed marriage. Janice, she'd been bitten. She knew she was throwing caution to the wind, but she didn't care and accepted. And they got married in March of 1981, after only knowing each other for just a few months. Here they were at the end of November, just the two of them, leaving family behind as Randy and Janice began hiking up Beacon Rock. The trail started off flat, it was pleasant, wide and peaceful. The climb to the top was just under a mile. Slowly, the grade increased. There were more than 50 switchbacks which had been carved directly into the side of the rock. As the couple climbed, the path narrowed and the wind blew, especially when they were on the exposed face of the rock. As they progressed, Janice could measure how high they were climbing by the view of the old-growth trees that towered around the landscape. When they started, of course, they were at the base of the tree. Then they could see the middle. And with each new switchback higher and higher, as the evergreen branches swayed and whipped vigorously in the wind, it was intimidating. And as Janice continued to climb with her new husband, who knew that she was afraid of heights. I mean, there were basic handrails which accompanied most of the path, but when he stopped and looked down, the feeling was sort of like a punch in the gut. It was breathtakingly beautiful. But it was also a really long way down, especially for someone who had impending thoughts of their own death on their mind. As Janice followed behind her husband, did she wonder why he wanted to take her on a romantic hike to Beacon Rock, just the two of them, when he knew she had a paralyzing fear of heights? Was she thinking about the $100,000 life insurance policy, something he insisted that she get, knowing that the policy had recently gone into effect just a couple of weeks before this hike? She tried to push those thoughts away and continued walking, but it was just so high up. And Janice was thinking about her death because of the nightmares she'd been having, something she'd shared with her friend Tim. She'd had dreams about dying. It didn't take a genius to interpret the dreams. Probably had something to do with the fact that she'd become scared of Randy. These fears were on her mind when, just days before, she'd brought her little girl into her bedroom, the one that she shared with Randy. Together they sat on the bed, next to the dresser. Her daughter watched her pull open a drawer until it came out, and turned it over, revealing an envelope that she taped to the bottom. It was filled with cash. It was then that she told her daughter that she'd been saving the child support from her father, and she looked into her child's innocent eyes and said, "If anything happens to me, I want you to take this money. Randy wants to adopt you, but I won't let him. And if something happens to me, I want you to go live with your father." Were these thoughts in Janice's head when her husband Randy looked back at his wife behind him on the trail? Was he smiling? Although there was no doubt that she had become afraid of her husband, she still had a hard time resisting his charm. He had a way. And on that day, is it possible that he took her into his arms and gently whispered into her ears the things that she longed to hear? Sweet enticements of what they might do together at the top. And then, together arm in arm, enjoying the incredible view of the Columbia River. In that moment, did he sense that his words hadn't shaken her anxiety? But he was confident in the ways of women. He knew his warm embrace was an intoxicant she couldn't refuse. So he looked deeply into her eyes, smiling. Was he suddenly everything that she thought he had been in the very beginning? And here they were at this romantic place? And he promising her an exhilarating experience, what she'd been longing for all these months. The two of them, standing on the summit together. A windswept place for them to enjoy the beauty of nature together, at the very top. A private expression of their love. Could that save their relationship? Janice continued the climb. Higher and higher. So high now that she could see the tops of those old growth trees, where just a short time before she'd been at their bases. Randy motioned for Janice to come over to a lookout point. The only barrier between the path and the gorge below was a very thin railing. And as the wind howled, at some point, Randy suggested that they go off the main trail. He gave her the look. It was a shortcut. He couldn't wait to get her to the top. Randy was so easy to be with when he was in a good mood. He could be like two different people. But she didn't like how controlling he'd become, even violent. But it was easy not to think about that when she looked into his eyes and yearned for what she saw reflected back. His love, his approval. Of course she followed him. When he looked at her like that, she would have followed him anywhere. And so they went off the main trail toward a secret place where the drop-off below made you gulp as you looked down. It was a devastatingly long way to the bottom. Hikers on the trail heard a man before they saw him, making his way down the switchbacks. It was Randy running, He passed the hikers without a word. And then he ran back, asking, "Have you seen my wife?" They shook their heads, saying no, worried. He responded, saying, "She insisted on leaving the trail to take a picture and had just disappeared while trying to get a better view." They asked if he'd notified the police. He hadn't. Then he went up to search for his wife, and the hikers went down and called the authorities. Search and Rescue would find Randy on the trail, where he would explain that he'd been hiking in front of Janice, and when he turned, he saw her going over the edge. Later, he would tell investigators that they had left the main trail for a secluded shortcut to the top, that Janice had gotten close to the edge, slipped, and fell. Randy would bring rescue workers to the spot where he saw his wife fall, and they would look, but they couldn't find Janice. In fact, it would take hours for first responders to find her. She'd fallen 300 feet. She was dead. From the beginning, investigators had their suspicions, but no one had seen Janice fall. No one except her husband. Investigators would perform a reenactment, and they would determine that it would have been nearly impossible for Janice to have fallen from where Randy said she had. Even if she had slipped, where he said she'd fallen, there were shrubs on the slope, which she could have grasped onto before slipping toward the drop-off. Police believed that Randy had possibly pushed his wife to her death, and they began looking into his background. Randall Roth was born on December 26, 1954. He was the oldest of five kids. Randy idolized his father, a taskmaster who ruled his family with an iron fist. Any signs of weakness were absolutely not tolerated. As a teenager, Randy had grown into a bully, a vandal, and a petty thief. After he graduated from high school, he went into the Marine Corps in 1973, where he was a clerk. But for all of his bluster, he couldn't hack the service. In fact, he begged his mother to write a hardship letter so he could be discharged after only a year of service, and she did, which meant Randy was spared serving in Vietnam. However, throughout his adult life, he would brag about his service. When he worked at the Ford Motor Company as a mechanic, he would tell a coworker that he could do somebody in without leaving marks. Other conversations consisted of Randy saying that he had to be deprogrammed after Vietnam because of all the people that he killed. And it's interesting because despite Randy's mother helping him out of the service, he would go on to reject her, describing her to people as being dead or mentally unstable. And Randy had issues with women. A high school girlfriend would describe him as being controlling and liking things under his power. Another girlfriend would flat out say Randy didn't like women or little girls, that he was paranoid and had a lot of weapons. Even though Randy was a bully who liked to dominate women, he was dangerous because he knew how to hide his shadow self. He knew how to be extremely charming, and he used this charm to get women under his control because they didn't see who he really was until it was too late. When Randy got out of the Marines, he continued to rack up charges on burglary and arson, while at the same time perfecting a certain kind of con on vulnerable women, charming them over a few months into marriage, then controlling their every move, which is exactly what happened in 1975 when he married Donna Sanchez. The couple would go on to have a son, Gregory, and in 1980, Randy would demand a divorce from Donna, but he insisted on getting full custody of their son. Then, in 1981, Randy met and married Janice in March. Now, 9 months later, she was dead after, according to Randy, accidentally falling off the edge of Beacon Rock. During Randy's interviews with police, he made conflicting statements as to whose idea it was to even visit Beacon Rock that day. Now, according to Randy, it had been Janice's idea all along to go on that romantic hike together, when in fact, family members would say that it had been Randy's idea. Detectives had also found out from Janice's mother that the relationship hadn't been going well. How Janice had told her mother that she wanted out of the marriage, and her husband had been violent towards her. A friend of Randy's would come forward. He told them that Randy was asking really weird what-if type questions about a month before Janice died. He was like, could you kill your own wife? Hypothetically, if the country was invaded, or if your wife had some incurable disease. The friend would tell police that he felt so uncomfortable by the tone and tenor of Randy's questions that he just wanted to change the subject. When Randy returned home to his parents' house where he'd been staying, remember, for that Thanksgiving weekend, he told Jelena that her mother had an accident and that she was in the hospital, when in fact, she was already dead. He wouldn't actually tell her that her mom had died for several days and wouldn't even allow her to attend the funeral. When Jelena and Randy returned home from that Thanksgiving weekend with Randy's dad and stepmom, she knew what she had to do. What her mother had told her to do. Just a few days before she died. And so she waited, biding her time for her stepfather to be occupied elsewhere in the home. And then, the 8-year-old plucked up the courage and went into her mother and stepfather's bedroom. She listened for Randy as she crept up to the dresser drawer, then quietly pulled out the drawer as she'd watched her mother do, removed the envelope that Janice had taped beneath. Then Jelena slowly inserted the drawer, trying not to make a sound as she pushed it back into its place, her heart pounding. She held on tightly to that envelope full of cash in her hand. She had just made it to the bedroom door when she nearly ran into Randy. He looked at her, then down to the envelope in her hand, and grabbed it. He poked a finger inside, thumbing through the bills, as he said, "Something else that she'd been hiding from me." Then, like a light switch changing from off to on, he looked at Jelena, smiled, and said, "I'm going to buy presents for you with this money." But Randy wouldn't buy presents for his stepdaughter. The day of Janice's death, Randy spoke with the funeral home and insisted that she be cremated. But he didn't contact any of her friends or family to let them know that she died. Early the next morning, he reached out to the insurance agent to submit a claim for Janice's life insurance. Remember, Randy had taken a $100,000 life insurance policy out on Janice that went into effect just weeks before her death. But despite investigators' suspicions that Randy had pushed his wife off of the cliff, they didn't have any evidence or even a witness. And so 4 months after Janice died, Randy would receive that check for $100,000. And he also sold the house that Randy and Janice had purchased together. None of the proceeds of either went to Janice's daughter, who went to live with her biological father within days after her death. Even so, Randy would submit paperwork to collect Social Security benefits for Jelena as her guardian, and he would collect those benefits for several months until the Social Security officials realized he didn't have custody of Janice's daughter, and so they cut him off. 4 years after Janice's death, Randy would meet Donna Cliff. She was a single mom with a 4-year-old daughter. After 3 months of dating, Donna was so in love with Randy that when he proposed, she said yes. Not long after, Randy would produce paperwork for her to sign for a life insurance policy that he'd taken out in her name. Donna took the paperwork, but she didn't sign the document. Because after they got married, Randy had begun to change. He had turned into a massive control freak. The romantic guy that she'd met was gone. And she became worried, especially after a rafting trip. It was just the two of them. And instead of rowing away from rough water, it appeared that her husband Randy was maneuvering into it on purpose. That was troubling. But something clicked after Donna found Janice's ashes in a box on the floor in the closet. She asked him for an explanation of what had happened to his former wife. And with dead eyes, Randy would say that Janice had slipped and fallen off a cliff. It had been an accident, that he'd grabbed onto her, but she slipped from his fingers. The way he shared these details, with zero emotion, Donna knew she needed out of the relationship before it was too late. And she left Randy after 3 months, fearing for her life. Randy tried to initiate another romance with a woman named Mary Jo, and he had charmed her into an engagement. But then he broke it off after he discovered that she was a cancer survivor and wasn't able to get life insurance. Hey, Criminal Mischief Nation. You know what I think when I see a Factor delivery truck in my neighborhood? I'm like, yes, I'm doing something good for myself and my family. And let's face it, I'm thinking you're a pretty smart mom because don't tell anyone, but I'm getting time back. It's a win-win because even though I love to cook, I love to bake, I'm going to be honest, I don't want to do it every day. But I also want to make sure that I'm not skimping when it comes to my family. And when you choose to order meals from Factor, I know that every delicious bite is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. And oh man, do they have choices. Which I'm going to tell you is a must because I have a big household with personalities as unique as their palates. And Factor offers over 35 different options to choose from every single week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and many, many more. And Factor isn't just about what's for dinner. They also offer a wide variety of options for the entire day, breakfast, midday bites, and more. And like I said, because Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup required. It really is a perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options without dirtying a dish or going grocery shopping. And because you're a Criminal Mischief listener, even more reason to try it out or start again because we're going to save you some money. So please head to factormeals.com/mischief50. That's M-I-S-C-H-I-E-F. 50 and use code MISCHIEF50 to get 50% off. That's code MISCHIEF50 at factormeals.com/MISCHIEF50 to get 50% off. Everything would change in the summer of 1990 when 34-year-old widower Cynthia Baumgarten was working at a Little League concession stand and Randy was there with his son, Greg. Immediately, Randy took an interest in Cynthia, initiating a conversation at the stand. He found out that she was raising two boys, a 9 and 11-year-old on her own. Her husband had tragically passed away at the age of 29 from cancer 5 years before. Cynthia's husband had left her financially secure so she could devote herself to her boys full time. She was grateful for that. Randy was grateful too. It took him only a month of dating before they were in Reno getting married on August 1st of 1990. After the honeymoon, Randy and his son Greg would move into her home, which the couple would sell and buy a bigger home together. Now, at the time, Cynthia already had a life insurance policy of $115,000. Her sons were the beneficiaries of that. But Randy insisted that she change her beneficiary to him. And he also wanted her to increase the payout to $385,000, which she did. As in every other relationship, once they were married, Randy's shadow side appeared in full force. He would control every aspect of Cynthia's life. The romance that she'd experienced was dead, replaced with Randy's disgust. He wore her down, despising everything about her, while at the same time, he didn't want her to do anything on her own. He wanted her to be 100% under his control. Right away, friends and family could see that Cynthia was struggling, that she had become timid and afraid. They knew it was because of Randy's coercive control, his toxic manipulation. Cynthia would express regret to her friends and family about her marriage. But as a very religious person, she just didn't believe in divorce. And this emotional and religious struggle wasn't the only thing that Cynthia was worrying about, but also the physical and mental abuse that her sons were enduring at the hands of their new stepfather. Cindy would write in her journal a 4-page list that detailed everything that her husband, Randy, hated about her. She wrote, "Randy does not love Cindy. Randy hates Cindy. Randy hates Cindy's face makeup. Randy hates Cindy's blush. Randy hates Cindy's lipstick. Randy hates Cindy's blonde hair. Randy hates Cindy's ugly toes. They're the ugliest toes he's ever seen. Randy hates Cindy's dolls in every room. Randy hates Cindy's pink, feminine things in every room." She would write how he hated the way that she drove, her furniture, her drawers, her pictures, the way she grinds her teeth, the way she buys groceries, how she decorates the house, how she cooks, how she volunteers. And then the pages would end with her writing that Randy hates telling Cindy where he goes, how he hates Cindy's monthly thing, how he hates putting up with her every month. Despite all this hate, Cindy would continue to try to make the best of it. In fact, she was even planning a romantic getaway to Reno, hoping that time away, just the two of them, would reignite the passion and love in their relationship. After all, on this trip, they would be celebrating their 1-year anniversary. A week before the Reno trip, Cynthia and Randy took her boys to Lake Sammamish. It was a gorgeous 90-degree summer day. So Cynthia set up her two sons at the supervised swimming section of the lake, and Randy pumped up the inflatable raft that he'd brought. She would tell the boys that she was going out on the lake with Randy, but that they'd be back. What she didn't tell them was that Randy had suggested a romantic paddle out to the deeper part of the lake, away from the crowded beach. Just the two of them, in that hot summer sun, spending romantic time together. After so much arguing, after so much hate, that sounded really nice. She just wanted everything to be like it was when they first met. Later that day, a family man named Patrick, he just settled his young children on the sandy beach for a picnic. And as he was leaning back on the blanket, enjoying the gorgeous water view with Mount Rainier in the distance, there was a lot of action on the lake, from speedboats to inner tubes to floaters, but Patrick noticed a man paddling in a gray raft, slowly, toward shore. He wasn't sure why the man captured his attention, and he actually quickly lost interest and went back to his picnic. At some point, Cynthia's boys would see their stepfather back on shore. They wondered why he was just sitting inside the raft, alone. And as they ran toward him, they wondered where their mother was. When they got to the edge of the raft, they were horrified when they saw their mother lying on the bottom in a few inches of water. Her face was blue and her body was motionless. And Randy was just sitting there in silence. He had been sitting there for 2 or 3 minutes, even before the boys had started running toward him. Suddenly he hissed, "Go get a lifeguard," without creating a fuss. The lifeguard would return quickly, and he pulled Cynthia from the raft and began administering CPR as Randy stood watching. Then he started deflating his raft, folding it up as first responders arrived to assist. They kept trying to revive her. EMTs would rush Cynthia to the hospital, but it was too late. She was dead. Her body would be transported to the medical examiner's office for autopsy, where it would be determined she had died from asphyxia due to drowning. Randy explained that the wake from a speedboat had caused the raft to flip while Cynthia was swimming next to it, and that was the reason that she drowned, despite his efforts to save her. But from the beginning, investigators were suspicious. Randy wasn't in any way acting like a grieving spouse, and he had a motive. He was the sole beneficiary of Cynthia's $385,000 life insurance policy. The medical examiner confirmed that there were no external or internal indications of trauma that would have led to Cynthia becoming unconscious. But he would also say that it would be relatively easy to drown a person without leaving any sign of forced drowning on the victim's body. After all, Cynthia was 5'2 and weighed 129 pounds, whereas Randy was 5'8 and 165 to 170 pounds. Randy wouldn't inform Cynthia's family. Her father found out about his daughter's death when he was watching the local news. As soon as Cynthia's body was released from the ME's office, Randy insisted that she be cremated, despite the strong objections of her parents. He never even picked up her ashes at the funeral parlor. But one thing he made sure to do right away was to submit a claim for his wife's life insurance policy. Meantime, detectives would interview Randy multiple times, and each time he had a different story. He would tell investigators that it was actually Cynthia's idea to row out to the middle of the lake because it would be romantic, that after about 10 minutes of swimming, she developed a leg cramp, how Randy had been in the water with her and began working his way around to the other side of the raft to steady it so she could get in. But then the wake of a boat passing 50 to 100 yards behind Cynthia hit her in the face. And because she'd been holding onto the rope that goes around the raft at the same time that the wake hit her, the raft flipped over on top of her. They listened to his explanation, but then they asked him, why did he wait so long to get help? Why did he say to his stepsons, get a lifeguard without creating a fuss? And Randy said that he did this in order to prevent a panic on the beach. But witnesses at the lake that day were troubled by his behavior. Here's Patrick, that father who'd been sitting on the beach with his family, the one who had witnessed Randy rowing ashore.
Approximately how far from you was that raft when you first saw it?
50 feet.
When you looked out over this body of water on July 23rd, 1991, and specifically when you looked at the defendant, did you notice any signs of distress coming from him?
None.
Did you see him stand up in the raft, wave, or try to get anybody's attention?
No.
Did you see him yell or look like he was yelling?
No.
Did he appear to be in a hurry?
No.
Patrick had taken his eyes off the raft that day, but he had no idea that a woman was dying at the feet of this man that was casually rowing. And when he looked back toward the raft, he saw that it was closer to the shore.
Did you see the raft again?
Yes.
Where was the raft when you saw it again?
Approximately 15 feet from the shore.
Right. And was the defendant still sitting in the raft?
Yes.
Was he still rowing?
Yes.
Which direction was he facing?
Facing the shore.
Okay. Did you notice any signs of distress coming from the defendant at that point in time?
No.
Did you see him trying to hail anyone at that point in time?
No.
And at what pace was he rowing?
Same.
Most of the witnesses who observed Randy that day when his wife was getting CPR, they had no idea that he was her husband. I mean, he was still wearing his sunglasses as he watched this lifeguard trying to revive his lifeless wife. They thought he was just a bystander.
How did he appear to you?
Reflective.
Okay. What do you mean by reflective?
He was, looked like he was thinking, like he looked like he was thinking. I mean, it looked like he was in, there's a word in French, but it's the one that keeps coming in my mind. It's pensif, which is to be thinking about, to be dealing with a problem.
Okay.
as if I was trying to figure out a way in a computer program. You get into that kind of a trance where you're thinking real hard.
Did he appear to be upset or distressed?
No.
So detectives are investigating this suspicious death of Cynthia Roth. They start putting together a timeline when suddenly a stream of unsolicited phone calls just pours in at the sheriff's office. People wanted to speak with the detectives who were working the case. They wanted to tell investigators about Randy's insurance scams, his petty thefts, and they wanted to tell him about Janice, his wife, who had also died accidentally. At the time, detectives had no idea about the accidental death of Janice Roth at Beacon Rock a decade before. But they wanted to know more, and so they took a trip out there. They wanted to know exactly how Janice had died. They recorded footage of their trek up the trail. Here's retired detective Randy Mullinex.
We're standing on the spot at Beacon Rock, on Beacon Rock, where Janice Roth fell in 1981. This is a spot that was pointed out by Randy Roth to Deputy Grossi within several days of the incident. What it is a trail that cuts between the normal walking path that is cordoned off by handrail. The path here is probably 6 to 8 feet in width at this particular spot, and we're told that Janice fell directly off here, and that her body was recovered later by the helicopter. I've climbed the area several times from the bottom, coming up what appear to be two different paths that could lead to this particular area here that would eventually take you to the next hand railing or the cutback where Mr. Roth said they were trying to get to. The path area itself here is probably 3 feet wide. You can see that on the top there are pine needles. Underneath it's solid packed dirt, maybe some roots, some rocks along here. You can see that it's pretty good footing in here leading up to the area where you go to the handrail. Over here the cliff slopes off slightly. Again, there's pine needles and a large rock under there. The footing is not bad, and below that there are small shrubs and trees that slope off quite steeply. Earlier there were four of us standing in this particular spot without much trouble. You just have to watch yourself as far as the path area itself. But again, we point out this is not the normal walking area up here. This is a shortcut.
The detective notices all the shrubbery, which, if Janice had somehow fallen, she most likely would have grabbed onto it as she fell to save herself from plunging 300 feet.
My life is at stake for this, and I have slipped off of here. There are plenty of things to grab onto here, along there, the brush. Even you can slide what appears to be 15 to 20 feet and still have maybe gotten a hold of brush, branches, tree limbs to have kept yourself from going on over the edge.
And the calls kept coming in. One tipster would tell detectives to speak with Randy's former best friend, Tim Bricado. Remember Janice's friend who she told she was having dreams that she'd died? This was the same friend who Randy had asked those weird what-if questions, if he'd be able to kill his wife. So detectives tracked down Bricado, who told them that Randy had staged a burglary at his home in 1988 to defraud an insurance company, that this was just one of Randy's many illegal schemes. And a female co-worker of Randy's called in too. They both were employed at a local car dealership. The woman would say how he would constantly trash talk his wife. In fact, the day before she died, he would say that he would soon be free of her. The day after Cynthia's memorial, Randy would reach out to this woman and asked her to go with him to Reno, using the tickets that Cynthia had bought to celebrate their anniversary. And Cynthia, like Janice, appears to have become concerned about her life. Not long before she died, she had drafted a will, and placed it in a safety deposit box. She would name her best friend, Lori Baker, as the guardian of her boys, not her new husband. But Randy didn't know that detectives had spoken to Lori about Cynthia's will when they interviewed him again on August 1st, a week after his wife had died. At the time, they asked him about her will, and Randy would say, "There's no will," or at least that's what he wanted everyone to believe. When Lori got access to Cynthia's safety deposit box, she found that it was empty because Randy had plundered it just 2 days after her death, taking her jewelry and her new will. What he didn't realize was that Cynthia had a second copy of her will, which was found at the county recording office. Randy wasn't concerned about the boys. What he wanted was their survivor benefits from Social Security. Here's the thing, even though there were tons of people at the beach that day, the only witness to Cynthia's death was Randy, which he claimed was an accident. Investigators would conduct a reenactment of the events based on Randy's statements. So they went out to the lake, and under the same conditions, they would determine that Cynthia's death was not an accident. It was murder. Her husband, Randy Roth, was arrested in October of 1991 on charges of first-degree murder. At the time, they also executed a search warrant on his home, where they found a Japanese martial arts book that described in detail the art of killing someone with one's bare hands. Knowing how Cynthia had died, this was obviously a significant find. But a detective would also take the time to smooth out a wadded-up clump of paper which had been stuffed into Randy's filing cabinet. It was that four-page letter that Cynthia had written titled, "Randy Hates Cindy," the one that described all the things that Randy hated about his wife. During the trial, prosecutors theorized that Randy had held Cynthia underwater long enough for her to drown, and then he purposefully slowly rowed back to shore to make sure there was no way that she could be revived. And during the trial, Randy's past would come back to haunt him. His third wife would testify about that terrifying river rafting experience where she got the impression that he had attempted to intentionally sink their raft. Another woman would testify that Randy had wanted to marry her but broke up the relationship after he found out that she was a cancer survivor and couldn't get life insurance. Even though they didn't have any physical evidence tying Randy to the murder of Cynthia, in court they were able to paint a very convincing picture that his motive for killing her was financial, and they showed the video reenactments on the lake, and they couldn't duplicate an accidental death based on what he told investigators had happened. A jury would deliberate for 8 hours before finding Randy Roth guilty of first-degree murder of Cynthia. He would be sentenced to 50 years in prison. He was never charged for Janice's death in 1981. Randy Roth will be eligible for parole in 2029, when he's 74 years old. Hey, did you know that every week on Criminal Mischief, we have a bonus episode? Here, my co-host, Brandon Morgan, and I discuss the case in more detail, and we go into other topics. It's a less formal conversation, so if you haven't already, give our bonus content a try. It's available right now. And as always, thanks for listening. From Cloud 10, Criminal Mischief is a Pie in the Sky production recorded in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're produced by Brandon Morgan and myself, music by Soundstripe. I'm Carolyn Osorio, your writer and host.
Hello, the world. We are They Will Kill, a true crime podcast. I'm Courtney Eck.
And I'm Sadie Eck. And we are sisters that want to tell you about lesser-known murders.
Our cases are always compelling, maybe even a little scary, with just enough banter to keep it interesting.
You can find us at theywillkill.com.
Or anywhere you listen to podcasts. See you there.
See ya.